Saudi Arabia is probably the country that is most supported by the U.S. The U.S. maintains a military presence in the Gulf that is ready to move and mobilize in case there is a threat to the oil fields. Also, Saudi Arabia is severely divided internally between tribal groups, and now, because of the sectarianization between Sunni and Shia, ideologically between liberal-minded Saudis and Islamists, and therefore this fragmentation prevents the development of national politics.
That's Madawi al-Rashid, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Madawi al-Rashid on Saudi Arabia, history and politics. Saudi Arabia is a quixotic ally of the United States, to say the least. 15 of the 19 9/11 hijackers were from the Desert Kingdom. In the wake of the attack, the U.S. flew Saudi elites out of the country and then proceeded to invade Afghanistan, though no Afghans were involved in 9/11. You figure it out. Saudi Arabia has supported extremist jihadi groups from Pakistan to Syria. In the 1980s, it bankrolled the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, who later morphed into the Taliban. When the latter seized power in the 1990s, Saudi Arabia was quick to recognize the new rulers in Kabul. Torture, hangings, and an atrocious human rights record have required Washington to engage in verbal acrobatics to justify its backing of the oil-rich Riyadh regime. Saudi Arabia is a feudal and closed system. How long can it last? Our guest today is Madawi al-Rashid, a leading scholar on Saudi Arabia. She's visiting professor at the Middle East Center at the London School of Economics, and she has taught at King's College in London. She's the author of A History of Saudi Arabia and A Most Masculine State. I talked with her at the University of Denver. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Saudi Arabia is an old land, but a relatively new country. How did its formation come about in the early 1930s?
Saudi Arabia is a recent country, a recent government that came out of the First World War, when part of the Arabian Peninsula was under the Ottoman Empire, that collapsed after the First World War, and Britain inherited that region as it fell within its sphere of influence when the British and the French were dividing the territory that had been part of the Ottoman Empire. So Britain, together with local forces, mainly the Al Saud and their allies, the Wahhabis, the religious interpretation that we know today as a radical Salafi movement. They came together under the sponsorship of Britain, and Saudi Arabia was created, and it was given the name the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in 1932. Then it was recognized as an independent country, but Britain remained sort of overlooking the affairs of Arabia until it was displaced by the United States during the Second World War. And with the discovery of oil, Saudi Arabia became almost like a satellite kingdom for the U.S.
And what is the structure of power? Who rules?
Saudi Arabia is an absolute monarchy. There is a king and a crown prince and a deputy crown prince. Unfortunately, the country doesn't have any institutions that represent the people, so there is no elected parliament or national assembly like other Gulf countries. It's an absolute monarchy. The king holds so many powers, and he rules with his son and nephew. So in the absence of any kind of national representation for the people, we can say that it is an absolute monarchy.
And getting back to the imperial settlement after World War I and the emergence of several countries in the Middle East, newly created countries, Lord Curzon was a former viceroy of India and the British Foreign Secretary after World War I. He said, speaking of British power, We need an Arab facade ruled and administered under British guidance and controlled by a native Mohammedan and as far as possible an Arab staff. There should be no actual incorporation of the conquered territory in the dominions of the conqueror, but the absorption may be veiled by such constitutional fictions as a protectorate, a sphere of influence, a buffer state, and so on.
That's a pretty accurate description of what the intent of the Brits were at the time. And it's a colonial policy that came under the disguise of indirect rule or a mandate or a protectorate. And there is this myth that Saudi Arabia has never been colonized. And even the current regime says that we had always been an independent country, we've never been colonized. But that's not true. Colonization came in different guises, from the settlers' colonization, where the imperial power brings some population, make them live there. This happened in South Africa, in Australia, and other countries. And there is the French style. But in Arabia, because of the sensitivity of having British troops or imperial troops on the ground early in the 20th century, as Saudi Arabia is the host of two holy cities that were important for British Muslims. And the Brits actually worried more about Muslims in India, who were more in number than any other Muslims. And as Britain controlled India, they didn't want to antagonize those Indian Muslims. And therefore, they did not have troops on the ground. But also, let's not forget, Arabia at the time didn't really offer much of an incentive for any foreign power to bring its troops there because there were no resources. It's an arid zone. The only resource before the oil was the pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina, in which thousands of Muslim participated and came every year. So any government that controlled these two holy cities could impose an entry tax on the pilgrims, and that's how Saudi Arabia emerged. When Ibn Saud expanded, his main project was to conquer Mecca and Medina and make them Saudi territories so he could have access to the taxes, the income from the pilgrimage, and also to have the Islamic credentials as the guardian of the two holy mosques.
That's really central to Saudi power, being the custodian of the two holy sites at Mecca and Medina.
Yes, absolutely. And they built their legitimacy on the basis that these two holy cities are under their jurisdiction, and therefore they should not be contested by any Muslim country. Even these Muslim countries are more, in terms of their population, there are countries that are triple the size of Saudi Arabian population. So they built this reputation, and also it meant that the Saudi regime tries to reach out to other Muslims through support, charity, aid, and also the export of its Wahhabi Islam. And they think by doing that, they are seeking legitimacy in the eyes of Muslims as far as Indonesia.
Talk about this cleric, Muhammad Abdul Wahhab, lived in the 18th century. What was his background, and how did Wahhabism emerge as central to the Saudi theology?
Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab was a cleric who lived in Central Arabia. It's one of the most isolated regions in Arabia. And his movement, called the Wahhabi movement, is part of a family of reformist movements that sprung everywhere in the Arab world and the Muslim world beyond Arab territories. These revivalist movements thought that Muslims are backward and their countries were beginning to be integrated in imperial sort of worlds that are run by non-Muslims. So they thought that if they reformed the practices of Muslims, if they brought Muslims to an early form, pristine Islam, then there is a hope for salvation. So initially, Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab was concerned with going around the villages in the Central Arabia, telling everybody that you should not practice your religion like that, you shouldn't pray like this, you shouldn't visit this tomb, you shouldn't seek intercession from saints who could act on your behalf with God. So he was trying to reform people's practices. But then the project took a very political turn when it was adopted by the Al Saud rulers of a particular town in Arabia called Diriyya. And they saw an opportunity to use that religious revivalist movement to spread their rule over other territories outside their little town. And this is exactly what they did, because if they spread their authority beyond their town, they could tax the population and impose on them Islamic tax. And this Islamic tax would actually end up in their coffers. So they struck a deal with Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, saying that we will help you spread your specific version of Islam, but you have to leave the political affairs and the taxes for us. And he was happy to do that. And since the mid-18th century, we have this bizarre relationship between the Al Saud and the descendant of Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, what is called today the religious establishment of Saudi Arabia. They support each other. Sometimes they come in conflict with each other, but most of the time they enforce each other's privileges and rule.
You describe the clergy in Saudi Arabia as overprivileged.
They're absolutely overprivileged, especially the loyalists among them, those who tell the population that you must obey the rulers. And if you demonstrate, you're actually committing a sin against God. If you criticize the king, you are undermining his authority and you're committing a sin. And therefore, we are here into sort of divine right of kings to rule. So the Wahhabis are very privileged as a result of preaching those kind of messages, and they are rewarded by having institutions created for them. They run the mosques, they preach, they are on the government's payroll.
Is Wahhabism and Salafism interchangeable, or do you make a distinction between the two?
Now, the people we call Wahhabis don't like to be called Wahhabis. They prefer to be called Muslims, and they think Wahhabi, the name Wahhabi, is a negative connotation because it means that they are followers of Muhammad Abdul Wahhab. They believe that they are just the true Muslims and the only true Muslims. Others have a lesser Islam or not a perfect one. And Salafis is a much older trend in Islam. It started in medieval time, and it was associated by a scholar called Ahmad ibn Hanbal, who lived in Baghdad, and he was trying to go back to the original text. It's almost like a fundamentalist movement that wanted to go back to the original text and offer literal interpretation of the Quran and the tradition of the Prophet, and not allow a lot of reasoning in understanding these ancient texts. So that is the Salafi movement. But the Saudis in the 20th century did not want to be called Wahhabis. They wanted to be called Salafis or pure Muslims because that gives them credibility beyond Arabia. So Muslims in India, Muslims in Indonesia, or anywhere in the world, by dropping the word Wahhabi, it makes the Saudi look as if they are actually the heirs of the true Islam.
Oil is discovered in Saudi Arabia, and U.S. becomes very interested in the country. In fact, there's a State Department document which calls the oil of Saudi Arabia a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the greatest material prizes in world history, probably the richest economic prize in the world in the field of foreign investment. And so the U.S. gets its hands on Saudi oil, and there was a meeting, a fateful meeting in 1945 in the Suez Canal, where Ibn Saud meets President Franklin D. Roosevelt on a U.S. warship, the Quincy. What happened there that is of importance?
What happened was that the U.S. formalized its relationship with Saudi Arabia. The relationship started first by the oil company that that began the search for oil. But after oil was discovered in commercial quantities in 1938, it was the oil company from Texas that drew the American government into Saudi Arabia because they wanted protection for the oil fields, which became extremely important for the U.S. especially during the Second World War. So there, in addition to the oil, there was the geostrategic location of Saudi Arabia as the U.S. acquired a military base very close to the oil field, which was used at the time for a stopover on the way to the Far East during the Second World War. But in addition to oil and security, we find that recently there was this element that the Saudi regime is actually an ally of the U.S. in the war against terror. So they claim that the Saudi shares intelligence with the U.S. and other Western government, for example, the British one, and the relationship must stay intact, and the special or the so-called special relationship should be maintained at all cost.
Just to back up a little bit, in 1943, Franklin D. Roosevelt said the defense of Saudi Arabia is vital to the defense of the United States. And the deal that apparently that was struck was that the U.S. oil companies would have exclusive access to the Saudi oil fields, excluding the British and the French.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the deal. In return for protecting the oil fields, the Saudis were not allowed to negotiate with any other international oil corporation, and there was a monopoly until the 1980s when Saudi Arabia regained Aramco, the Saudi oil company, and reverted to the in its ownership to the Saudis. But American expertise, American personnel continued to dominate the oil industry in Saudi Arabia, in addition to the defense industry that the Saudis started. So Saudi Arabia today buys most of its arms, weapons, airplanes from the United States, although in later years they tried to diversify by some of this this armament from Europe and also China and beyond.
In 2015, King Abdullah dies and is succeeded by Salman. What is he like? What do you know of him? Is he any kind of a reform-minded leader?
Well, King Salman is a traditional patriarch, a monarch, who is interested in ensuring the survival of the Al Saud dynasty at all costs. He, under his rule, many human rights activists and people who were actually campaigning for greater freedoms, for lifting the ban on driving when it comes to women's rights, for establishing civil society, even those who called for constitutional monarchy using peaceful means, like writing petitions, were put in prison. And King Salman continued the tradition of King Abdullah by keeping them in prison. He has not pardoned anybody. And the repression in Saudi Arabia under King Salman continues.
Now, there's something unusual in many things are unusual about Saudi Arabia, but this religious, so-called religious police, and it sounds like almost an Orwellian term, the Commission for the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice. These, and you've written about this, these government-appointed moral vigilantes parade the streets in luxurious white four-wheel drives in search of immorality, enforcing gender separation laws, making sure that all shops are closed during prayer times and that men and women dress modestly at all times.
Yes, it is translated in English as religious police. The interesting thing is King Salman, just recently, he passed a royal decree that limited their ability to arrest people, chase women in the streets. And this was done in order to promote this image that Saudi Arabia now is a neoliberal economy, and it is basically promoting a consumer sort of citizenship, that you have to go to shopping center, feel free to shop without harassment by the religious police. Yet they still keep the tradition of telling people to close their shops when it's prayer times. And the interesting thing, this royal decree came into being exactly at the same time as ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, was following the path of Saudi Arabia and imposing these kind of restrictions on the people who came under their authority. So there were so many common grounds between ISIS and Saudi Arabia, at least at this level, which prompted King Salman to ban the religious police from following people until they are authorized by the real police. So it's interesting parallels to see that the only time when the king actually limited the powers of the religious police is when ISIS was beginning to follow the same pattern and imposing these restrictions on its own, the people who came under its control in Mosul and Raqqa, for example.
And in terms of women's rights, gender issues, what about divorce and property?
Saudi Arabia applies Islamic law in the case of personal issues such as marriage, divorce, and inheritance, like all Arab and Muslim countries. When it comes to personal status law, they apply Sharia, which is Islamic law. However, Saudi Arabia applies the most restrictive interpretation of Islamic law in matters related to personal affairs. So women find it very, very difficult to divorce, because divorce remains the prerogative of men. And Saudi judges, who are all male, of course, are sympathetic to a male version of the Islamic tradition. And the women have a very hard time getting divorced. And if they do get divorced, usually they find it very difficult to get custody over their children and also maintenance from their ex-husband, especially if they are looking after the children. So the problem does not lie in Islamic law itself. It is in the interpretation of Islamic law, especially when a country adopts the most restrictive interpretation.
A few years ago, there was a bit of a brouhaha about women driving. What is the status of that? Can women drive cars in Saudi Arabia?
Absolutely not. And with the advent of the internet and social media, a lot of Saudi women have started campaigns and hashtags wanting to drive. The virtual campaign attracts a lot of sympathizers, but if women dare to practice what they want, and that is taking their cars for a drive, they immediately get arrested. So we still have the ban on driving.
The Daily Telegraph in Britain reports that women are required to limit the amount of time spent with men to whom they are not related. The majority of public buildings, including offices, banks, and universities, have separate entrances for the different sexes. Public transportation, parks, beaches, and amusement parks are also segregated in most parts of the country. Unlawful mixing will lead to a criminal charge being brought against both parties, but women typically face harsher punishments. Are those descriptions accurate?
They are accurate, but also they're not at the same time. So in general, there are restrictions on where women can be. For example, you can't work with a man in an office. But there are pockets and enclaves in the country where mixing takes place. Take, for example, the Kingdom Holding, which is the company of Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, the entrepreneur. In his company, men and women mix freely. Take another example. King Abdullah started a university called King Abdullah University for Science and Technology. And from the very beginning, it's a mixed college. In hospitals, men and women work together, and there are women nurses. Most of them tend to be non-Saudis, but it is allowed. And therefore, we have this hypocrisy that we are a Muslim country. We don't allow men and women who are unrelated to mix together. But at the same time, there are these pockets of mixing between the sexes that the government keeps a blind eye on and don't bother to investigate. But it actually depends on who we are talking about. If you're wealthy, you're able to have security guards guarding the entrance to your office in the private sector. You're not going to get the religious police to harass you inside. And in fact, if you are a prince, you make sure that they do not set a foot in your company's building. But if you are an ordinary citizen, you know, you want to just go in the cafe in Saudi Arabia, sit and have a cup of coffee and happen to just like exchange a word with a man, you might actually get arrested.
There are millions of foreign workers in Saudi Arabia, and there's, you know, reports coming out about abuse and rape and people not getting paid and they're being beaten and the like. What is known about the foreign workers, where they're from, and their numbers?
Saudi Arabia has approximately 9 million foreign workers. Some of them are very privileged Western expats who work in very highly well-paid jobs. But the majority of them are either Arabs who work in middle management or Asian and African labor. Their situation is precarious. The government can get rid of them anytime. They can be deported easily. They do not have the right to establish their unions. And recently, with the decline in oil prices, we find a lot of construction workers in the private sector are not paid their salaries because the companies have lost contracts with the government and they can't pay their employees. So those ones stay in the country for a couple of months because the employer keeps their passports. You cannot leave Saudi Arabia without the permission of your sponsor. And sometimes they went to the streets and demonstrated and went on strike because they weren't paid. So what happens is the government cooperates with the private sector. They just put them on planes and ship them back to their country.
And are all of these 9 million foreign workers Muslim?
It's a mixture. There are some who come from the Philippines who are obviously not Muslim, but there are also Chinese immigrants, and some of them are Muslim from Bangladesh, Pakistan, and other countries in the Muslim world or Africa.
To go back to the post-World War II period where this alliance solidifies between Washington and Riyadh, it seems that beyond oil, which was a primary concern, of course, for the U.S., there was this fervent anti-communism as well as any kind of Arab independent nationalist movement.
Yeah, Saudi Arabia was a key ally of the U.S. during the Cold War, and both countries wanted to defeat the Soviet Union and also defeat the threatening or what they called subversive ideologies such as socialism, communism, and Arab nationalism. Ironically, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia mobilized Muslims by deploying the Wahhabi tradition and as an antidote to these sort of secular ideologies. So if the belief was that if people went back to Islam, were preoccupied with being good Muslims, then they wouldn't actually fall into the trap of being attracted to the godless communists or even secular Arab nationalists. So Saudi Islam served a purpose during the Cold War, and it was spread by the Saudi regime using petrodollar to places as far as London, Jakarta, and even in the U.S. So it was that moment when we see a lot of mosques and charities sponsored by the Saudis spreading around the globe, spreading also this Wahhabi tradition.
You're listening to Madawi Ar-Rashid on Saudi Arabia, History and Politics. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Speaking of Pakistan and neighboring Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia played a key role after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in December of 1979, helping to supply and fund the Afghan Mujahideen.
Yes, absolutely. Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister of Britain at the time, Ronald Reagan, and the Saudi intelligence services worked together and sent arms to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan via Pakistan with the help of the Pakistani intelligence services. They sponsored them, they armed them, and also they precipitated a global jihadi movement with no exit strategy after the end of the Afghan war in 1988. So these jihadis who had been trained in the art of using arms, they had to leave Afghanistan and they spread around the globe.
And the Saudi national, Osama bin Laden, of course, was part of that movement in Afghanistan, and Al-Qaeda is formed, I believe, in Pakistan in 1988 or 89.
Yes, absolutely. You're right. This is what happened. And the Saudi national, Osama bin Laden, went from Jeddah, where he grew up, to Afghanistan and established the base, Al-Qaeda, in order to host all the Arab Afghans, those Arabs who wanted to fight in Afghanistan, so they were called the Arab Afghans. Now, the Saudis say that he was acting as an independent actor without government approval or sanction. But the Saudis themselves, the Saudi government, ironically, King Salman himself, used to raise money for the Afghan jihad. And it was reported that the Saudis who wanted or expressed a wish to go to travel to Afghanistan and fight there were getting a 25% discount on Saudi airline to travel to Pakistan and join the jihadis there.
And then there's also alleged connections between the regime in Riyadh and the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and more recently with ISIS. Is there any support for that allegation?
The Saudis definitely worked with the jihadis in Afghanistan, and the mujahideen, the main figures in the Afghan jihad, used to visit Riyadh as much as they visited other Gulf countries, Qatar and elsewhere. Therefore, you know, they entered into an intimate relationship, and it wasn't actually released into the public, the degree by which the Saudis were entrenched in that Afghan experience. Now, we come several decades later to Syria and Iraq, and whether Saudi Arabia is involved. Saudi Arabia claims that it supports moderate rebels in Syria and does not support the jihadis or Al-Qaeda or the others who are operating in Syria. However, in a chaotic civil war like the one that has been raging in Syria for 5 years, it's very difficult to know where Saudi arms money is going and if these arms and support is actually switching hands and moving from the so-called moderate ones to the radical ones. It's a chaotic situation, and my guess is that Saudi Arabia is heavily involved in arming rebels who may actually have been affiliates of Al-Qaeda or IS.
The 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran greatly disturbed the rulers in Riyadh. Why was it? What was so threatening about the Iranian revolution to Saudi Arabia?
Two things. The first one is the success of Islamist groups, this time the Shia Islamists, who participated in a revolution. And they were not the only ones. There were other groups in Iran, but they sidelined everybody else, seized power, and established an Islamic Republic. The Saudis feared that model because it might act as an inspiration for the Islamists among the Sunni groups from Morocco all the way to Indonesia. So the Islamic revolution in Iran was a catalyst that brought to mind the minds of these Arab dictators that this could happen inside our countries. Now it is so close, we can't avoid it. So we have to prepare ourselves for a counter strategy. The second issue that worried Saudi Arabia was that Iran immediately wanted to export its model of Islamic government. Although this Islamic government is specific to the Shia Muslims, the Saudis feared that it will act as an inspiration for its own Shia minority that lives in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia. They're just living on top of the oil fields, actually. And this was very worrying. And immediately in 1979, we have an incident that confirmed the fears of the Saudi regime. The Shia of Saudi Arabia started an uprising inspired by Khomeini, the Iranian leader. And so there was a worry about how far the Iranian government is going to go to inspire people, either indirectly or even directly.
And that, of course, plays out today with the war in Syria and, you know, issues dealing with Lebanon and other countries that have large Shia populations. The common refrain from so-called experts in the United States, you know, about Islam is that it rejects modernity, it never embraced the Enlightenment. There's this sectarian divide between Sunnis and Shias. It's based on age-old animosities and hatreds, you know, ancient tensions. How much of this is Orientalism, you know, repackaged in 2017?
It's a lot of Orientalism, I would say. The conflicts in the Middle East are real and they are modern. They don't go back to the 12th century or 11th century or 7th century. There are modern contexts, modern conditions, above all, the repression that is prevalent in all Arab countries. It's been entrenched since the Second World War. And people had some kind of hope in 2011 that through peaceful action, they can change this. And of course, counter-revolutionary forces such as the Saudi regime armed certain rebels, making the militarization of this peaceful protest possible, and derailed the drive towards a democratic government, justice, and dignity, basically. So the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran is not about being Sunni and Shia. It's a rivalry between two countries. Both are seeking to establish themselves as the main arbiters of Arab affairs.
The first uprising was in Tunisia in December of 2010. That was followed almost immediately by Egypt, Libya, Syria, and incidentally Bahrain, which was invaded by Saudi troops. What was the response from Riyadh to these uprisings? I think they must have found it very threatening.
Two responses. At the level of regime, it was seen as a threat. So they immediately tried to support all the weak and poor monarchies, such as the Moroccan one and the Jordanian one. And they immediately moved their troops to Bahrain to support the Al-Khalifa rulers against the uprising. And however, they also saw in some of the revolutions, or you might call them uprisings, a window of opportunity. And this is the Syrian case. When the Syrian people started demonstrating peacefully, the Saudis thought that this is an opportunity to topple Bashar al-Assad, who's an ally of Iran. So it's very hard to believe that Saudi Arabia, an absolute monarchy, wants to bring democracy to the Syrian people when it suppresses its own activists at home. So Saudi intervention in Syria is a bid to expel Iran and, in fact, cut the line of supply between Tehran and Beirut. The invasion of Iraq in 2003 gave Iran a sort of a living room, an extension in Iraq, and its influence is undoubtedly so obvious in Iraq. And then you have Syria, where it had always had a good influence, and of course in Lebanon among Hezbollah, the southern Shia militia. And therefore, Syria was critical, Damascus was critical, and the Saudis saw that if they could topple Bashar, they could cut the line of supply between Tehran and Beirut.
Now, historically, Egypt has always been the center of Arab politics and culture. The dictatorship of Mubarak is toppled in early 2011. A series of things happen, and then Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood is elected president. There's a coup d'etat on July 3rd, 2013, and a military ruler takes power, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. He remains in power. He met with President Trump and was praised by President Trump. How did Saudi Arabia respond to the uprising in Egypt and then the subsequent election of Mohamed Morsi as president?
The Saudi regime was totally devastated by the toppling of Mubarak that happened over such a short period of time. And what really upset the Saudis was how President Obama at the time didn't come to rescue Mubarak, seen as an important ally, at least for Israel, and for peace in the Middle East. So the Saudis were terrified by this cataclysmic event. Remember, Egypt is the most populous country in the Arab world. It had produced several ideological trends in the past. Remember that Egypt at the beginning of the 20th century brought modernity to the Arab world through its art, through film, through the philosophy that its intellectuals produced, through the writing of its professionals. So it brought modernity. Then in mid-20th century, it brought Arab nationalism, which threatened the Saudis with Jamal Abdel Nasser, the president of Egypt at the time. Then in the 70s, it brought Islamism, because remember, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, Hassan al-Banna, started the Muslim Brotherhood movement in Egypt in 1927. It didn't really crystallize and gain momentum until the 70s. So these three trends were threatening to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia rejected the modernity of Egypt, rejected the Arab nationalism, and then it was stuck with this Islamism. You would think that a Saudi regime that claims to apply Sharia, Islamic law, and think of itself as the unique, exceptional Islamic state would actually welcome the election of Morsi to the post of president in Egypt. But the Muslim Brotherhood represent a challenge for Saudi Arabia because they were able to sort of, through their writing and mobilization, to bring a model of Islamic government that can marry in some sort of obscure way Islam with democracy. And because the Muslim Brotherhood participated in several elections before, many people thought that perhaps this is the model for the Muslim world. They can't be immediately sort of given or develop into liberal democracies like we have them in the West. Perhaps a sort of kind of Islamic democracy is possible. And this was threatening to Saudi Arabia because it goes against an absolute monarchy, which doesn't have any kind of elections, doesn't have a legitimacy beyond hereditary rule. And therefore, the Saudis were alarmed by the election of Mohamed Morsi. And within 12 months, they helped counter forces, and specifically General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, in order to stage a coup that toppled Morsi, who ended up in prison.
I remember Noam Chomsky telling me about the Muslim Brotherhood, that it was also a social welfare organization, providing services that the state, the Egyptian state, would not or could not provide, literacy programs, training, health clinics, and the like.
Yes, the Muslim Brotherhood is unique among Islamist groups in the sense that it combined its role as a preaching forum. It combined that with being also a charity organization with a huge network of hospitals and schools. It also penetrated trade unions in a country like Egypt, among professionals, lawyers, doctors, etc., but also as a political party. So these three dimensions made the Muslim Brotherhood threatening for a regime like Saudi Arabia. And they distinguished themselves by pursuing these kind of three paths from other Islamists, such as, for example, Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda doesn't think or didn't think of itself as a charity or a preaching community of preachers. It was embedded in an armed struggle against, so many enemies, the West, the Arab regimes, and every Muslim who didn't conform to their way of being Muslim. So the unique tradition of the Muslim Brotherhood was threatening, and this is why the Saudis put their weight behind Sisi and are happy now to develop closer military and financial relations with him, although the relationship can sometime have a troubled moment.
Saudi Arabia was a long time, at least on a rhetorical level, a champion for Palestinian rights. How has that changed in recent years? Because it seems to have been quite modified.
Since the Arab uprising, I think the Arab-Israeli conflict, or the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, to put it more accurately, had been sidelined. It is no longer the main preoccupation of the Arab population or the regimes. Each regime is now preoccupied with its survival. We have an authoritarian system that's spreading across the Arab world and beyond to that, in Europe, in the West itself. And therefore, there are serious economic problems in countries like Egypt and North Africa, in addition to Saudi Arabia itself. An oil-based economy is suffering in Saudi Arabia because of the collapse of oil prices. So the Saudis may make noises about the peace process, but there isn't really an effort to push for peace or for more rights to the Palestinians.
And there have been reports that Saudi Arabia has made overtures with Israel based on their mutual antipathy toward Iran.
Absolutely. We've heard these reports, and jokingly, some people think that Israel has become a Sunni ally of Saudi Arabia. We don't know the degree to which the two countries are working together, but my guess is that there had been some meetings that were publicized, not by the Saudis. Unfortunately for the Saudis, we hear about those meetings from the Israeli press.
Iqbal Ahmed was a great Pakistani intellectual and anti-imperialist, and he often reminded audiences here in the U.S. and Europe and Canada that there were two kinds of jihad. You only hear about one kind here, the militant, aggressive type of jihad, but there's another type of jihad in Islam.
Absolutely. There are so many interpretations of jihad, but at the moment, the whole world thinks that there is only one armed struggle is the jihad that Muslims are engaged in. But that's not true. In Islamic tradition, we have a rich body of knowledge about scholars who wrote about jihad as a struggle to maintain good life, moral life, as a struggle also to defend yourself. You defend your property, which is an obligation in Islam, like it is recognized in international law. If somebody invades your country, you are under the obligation to actually defend your borders. So there are multiple meanings of jihad, but unfortunately, in the present context of the volatile life in the Middle East, we find that jihad is reduced to this particular type of jihad. And unfortunately, it has become synonymous with terrorism.
Sometimes I make the analogy that Saudi Arabia is akin to the Walton family that owns Walmart. It's like a privately run family business. Do you give any credibility to that?
I think it is a private corporation with multiple princes having shares in it. It is run secretly with minimum participation from society. There are no institutions that allow Saudis to decide on policy, even when it comes to economics. The recent announcement that was made by the Deputy Crown Prince Mohammed ibn Salman, he called his economic reform program Vision 2030. It came top down. And also it was a blueprint that was constructed, imagined by a management consultancy firm from outside Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is a closed system. The only people who can decide on important matters are a coterie of important senior princes.
Why is Saudi Arabia in the war in Yemen?
The Saudi regime started this war in order to absorb the shock of its failure in the Arab world from Beirut to Baghdad. Saudi Arabia had seen its sphere of influence and acumen among those countries or important elite in those countries shrink in the past sort of 5 years. And also, it saw the expansion of the Iranian influence. And therefore, the Saudi king began to lose his credibility in the eyes of his own local audiences, that he wasn't doing anything. after all, he's supposed to defend Muslims and Sunni Muslim in particular, but he wasn't able to do anything about it. And that was during King Abdullah. But in 2015, when King Abdullah passed away, Salman wanted to come and show how masculine and militaristic he is, that Saudi Arabia is serious, tough, and it's going to fight the Iranians in their backyard in Yemen. And this is why he announced Decisive Storm, which was the name given to his war on Yemen, unfortunately, the poorest Arab country. And so far, since 2015, there are 10,000 people, civilians, who had died as a result of this bombing and the fighting that went in Yemen, according to the United Nations sources. So he also adopted or began to be referred to in the local press as the King of Decisiveness. Compare that, the King of Decisiveness, to King Abdullah, who before was known as the King of Humanity. So the King of Humanity gave way to the King of Decisiveness, thus bringing out all this masculine militaristic traits and show how tough he is despite his old age.
And Yemen, again, in the media, is reduced to Shia-Sunni conflict.
That's absolutely irrelevant as a way of understanding the Yemeni conflict. The Houthis are Zaydis, but they are fighting with Ali Abdullah Saleh, the ex-deposed president of Yemen, and it's all about sharing power and resources. However, quite a lot of the Middle Eastern conflicts get derailed and take a sectarian flavor simply because there are people who are intent on making them sectarian, because religious conflicts are very difficult. They sort of arouse emotions. They make people passionate. If you talk about these conflicts as if they are conflicts about sharing resources, about sharing limited resources sometimes, such as in the case of Yemen, and also sharing power, people want to have a stake in the system. And if they are marginalized or expelled from the system and the benefits, then they're going to stage a rebellion. And this is exactly what happened in Yemen. As a result, foreign intervention, the Saudis and the UAE, let's not forget that other Gulf countries are helping the Saudis. There are 10 countries in the coalition in this war in Yemen. But of course, the Saudis are the leaders of this war. And to think of the Yemeni conflict as a Sunni-Shia one is very, very simplistic.
Nothing lasts forever. I remember President Jimmy Carter toasting the Shah of Iran in 1978, saying that Iran was an island of stability and the Shah was a great leader. Within a year, he was gone. What do you see in terms of the long term for the survival of this feudal monarchy in Saudi Arabia?
There are times when the arrangement of this absolute monarchy is not going to work. Saudi population is becoming aware of what's happening. What is actually keeping the lid on a pressure cooker is the civil wars that are raging in the Arab world. These civil wars have intimidated Saudis, who would normally call for reform, at least political reform, that doesn't topple the monarchy necessarily, but bring about some kind of citizen involvement in politics. I see some bad moment coming, but remember, Saudi Arabia is probably the country that is most supported by the U.S. The U.S. maintains a military presence in the Gulf that is ready to move and mobilize in case there is a threat to the oil fields. And this intimidates people who may actually mobilize. Also, Saudi Arabia is severely divided internally between tribal groups, and now, because of the sectarianization between Sunni and Shia, ideologically between liberal-minded Saudis and Islamists. And therefore, this fragmentation prevents the development of national politics. And there are no cross-tribal or cross-ideological solidarities developing. And the Saudi regime, by inhibiting civil society, it delays the emergence of alternative leadership that could take the country to a different level, becomes a modern democratic country.
Were you born in Saudi Arabia?
I was born outside, but it was just a historical accident, and I lived in Saudi Arabia almost all my childhood and sort of teenage years. And then I went to England to study, and I remained there simply because of my writings. My books are banned in Saudi Arabia. And in fact, there was an incident just a couple of years ago where a couple of human rights activists got access to my books and my articles, and they downloaded them in PDF file on their computers, and they were arrested because they established a human rights organization. And one of the charges against them, and this I'm talking here about Mohammed Libjadi, Amnesty International reported that one of the charges against him, together with another judge who was like 75-year-old judge, Suleiman Rushudi, was that they had read my books and articles and had them downloaded on their computer screens. So in a way, it's a very difficult situation for Saudi activists to have access and also be supported, especially at this moment when repression is on the rise.
And do you have family in the country, and can you go back?
I can't go back myself because of my writings, and also the Saudi government withdrew my nationality in 2005 because I went on television and criticized the decision of the government not to include women in the municipal election as voters and candidates.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
You were just listening to an interview with Madawi Ar-Rashid on Saudi Arabia, history and politics. I talked with her at the University of Denver. Madawi Ar-Rashid is a leading scholar on Saudi Arabia. She's visiting professor at the Middle East Center at the London School of Economics and the author of A History of Saudi Arabia and a Most Masculine State. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Rami Khoury, Vandana Shiva, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Arundhati Roy, Chris Hedges, and Tariq Ali. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Madawi Ar-Rashid on Saudi Arabia, History and Politics, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Nader Hashimi. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.